Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On Monday, a flood in the streets of Iran's cities. The popular pushback against last week's election results swelled from big and loud to huge and historic. The biggest crowds of people power in the streets of that country since the fall of the Shah and triumph of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. This is history unfolding for Iran and the world. It's not over, and it's not easy to read from the outside. This hour on Point, Iran's turmoil and what's really going on in the uproar. You can join the conversation. Are you riveted? What do you see unfolding in Iran? Is the house that Ayatollah Khomeini built in 1979 being shaken to its core? What's going on? What's at stake in the famously Islamic Republic? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here are the pro-Mousavi protesters on Monday in Tehran. Absolutely enormous crowds there at the beginning of the week. And here, amateur video showing an apparent attack by plainclothes policemen on Tuesday at a university dormitory in Tehran. History still unfolding. And joining us now from Tehran in Iran, Roger Cohen, columnist for the New York Times. Roger Cohen, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
What's going on today? And can you tell? We understand there are restrictions on foreign journalists now.
There's another demonstration by supporters of Mousavi. It's not clear yet how large it is. Restrictions are growing more and more severe on our ability to work, and correspondents are leaving Iran as their visas expire. No visas are being renewed and work permits are being revoked. So it's becoming more and more difficult, but I've been out in the streets, the last few days as much as possible, and certainly the huge rally a couple of days ago with perhaps a million people was, in what alas at this point for me is a rather long journalistic career, one of the more extraordinary and moving events I've ever witnessed. Just an immense number of people, a tremendous dignity and tremendous outrage at what millions of Iranians see as the stealing of their votes.
Roger, we're reading reports now of people lining the rooftops in Iranian cities after dark, chanting in protest, of spontaneous demonstrations breaking out in subway stations. Of course, these crackdowns by paramilitary in student dormitories around the country. Mousavi calling for a mass peaceful rally tomorrow to honor those who have been killed so far. Is your sense of this protest, Roger, and it may be impossible to say, but is your sense that it's still mounting, that it's plateaued, that where are we in the arc of this story? Is it possible to say?
I don't think it's possible to say definitively. Everybody's breath was taken away by what happened in the rally 2 days ago. There'd been a concerted attempt by the regime to prevent the rally, cutting down all forms of communication, text messaging, cell phones, repeated reports on the radio every 10 minutes that the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei had referred the election results to the Guardian Council, clearly playing for time, but it was also an attempt to stop the rallies by saying, hey guys, we are looking into this. That didn't stop anything. And yes, every night from the roofs around where I am, there are Mousavi supporters crying out Allahu Akbar, God is great, and other slogans. And it's not dying down, that much I can tell you. And if anything, it's growing. At the same time, the repression designed to stop it is growing. It's harder and harder to communicate. It's harder and harder to report on. But, of course, media these days is extremely diverse. Twitter is being used. Any means possible is being used. And word of mouth is extremely effective. At each rally, a word is passed out as to where and when the next rally will take place. And little signs, I was out in the street an hour ago, and the police helicopter passed overhead, and I saw a number of pedestrians not involved in any rally or anything, just making the V sign, V for victory, that has become the emblem of the Mousavi campaign, making that sign to the heavens, well, in this case, to the helicopter. People have little green ribbons on the, on their fingers or attached to bags of various parts of their possessions or bodies, and in that way they convey their solidarity with each other. But it's very clear that the regime made a decision to take an extremely hard line, and Ahmadinejad's victory, apparently and according to them, an overwhelming victory, two-thirds of the vote. I've never seen a victory by two-thirds of the vote accompanied by such savage repression. And as you know, there was a 98% correlation in the votes for Ahmadinejad across every region of the country, whatever its social status, whatever its ethnic nature. The line for Ahmadinejad just goes straight up in a straight line. There is almost no variation nationwide. All this simply begs the question, is this at all credible? And frankly, it's not.
Roger, we cannot know the future. What do you see as the most likely options or paths? What are the alternatives for what may unfold here?
Well, that's, of course, the key question that you've posed, Tom. There are all kinds of scenarios. I mean, the Guardian Council is looking into the election. It could, in theory, determine that there had been mass fraud and call for a new election. That is what Mousavi is seeking. He's not seeking a recount because he doesn't believe in it. He's seeking annulment and a new election. On the face of it, that the Guardian Council would do that seems highly implausible. It is stuffed with Ahmadinejad supporters. It's a 12-member body. One of the six lawyers on the council is, in fact, the spokesman for the Ahmadinejad government. So that gives you some idea of its nature. A huge question is whether the momentum that I've described can be maintained. Can you go on day after day bringing tens, hundreds, even perhaps millions of people out into the street? And will, at some point, the regime, the government, resort to more savage repression of a Tiananmen Square nature? I mean, the police and we haven't seen the army on the streets, and the elite riot police, black-clad on these motorcycles, is brutal. They go around, as are the Basij, the militia. I've seen them striking women with their batons, whipping people, absolutely brutal. But what they have not done, although there have been isolated incidents of Basij shootings and killings, they have not opened fire. And the size of the demonstration 2 days ago was such that I think that became an impossible option just by the sheer size of it. So are we going to see more brutal use of force by the government, and are we going to see this momentum continue to grow? I think at this point you have to say, just given that the monopoly of military force still lies with the state, with the government, that the likelihood has to be that they will tough this out. But we've seen extraordinary events here in recent days, and I'm not prepared to rule out that the demonstrations will grow. And at that point, does Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader, decide that he has to dispense with Ahmadinejad? That is always an option for him.
Roger Cohen, I hope to talk with you again soon, but we're so grateful to have caught you in Tehran today. Thank you for your work there, and thanks for speaking with us today, Roger.
Pleasure, Tom. Pleasure.
Roger Cohen with The New York Times, joining us from Tehran, Iran. Let's go now to Cambridge, England, and Azadeh Moaveni. She is author of Lipstick Jihad, a memoir of growing up Iranian in America and American in Iran. Most recently, of Honeymoon in Tehran, her most recent book, Iranian-American, contributor to Time magazine, reported for years from Iran and the Middle East. It was last in Iran in January. Azadeh Moaveni, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
In the couple of minutes we have before a break here, just give us your kind of plain, basic explainer. What is going on in Iran right now?
What I'm seeing, and I lived in Iran for almost 3 years under Ahmadinejad's presidency, is really just the final sort of eruption of rage with his incompetent 4 years of rule. I don't think this is just a protest against electoral fraud, although I think that outrage provoked these protests. But I think that what we're seeing, the scale of what we're seeing on the streets, really reflects an even more profound anger and frustration with the Iranian government, especially the course that it's taken under Ahmadinejad. It's come to be more unaccountable than ever, corrupt, indifferent to the rule of law. And of course, the economy has deteriorated. Ahmadinejad is personally responsible for gutting the economy. I think that young people in so many walks of life have felt their quality of life deteriorate. And I think what we're seeing, the tremendous diversity of the faces on the street is the diversity of the opposition to Ahmadinejad on the one hand, and also people's profound discontent and anger with this government on the other hand.
We've got to take a break in just a second, but the last time we saw crowds this big on the streets of Tehran, it was 1979, and the whole order in Iran changed. Do you see that as a possibility this time, or is this something more in the margins?
I don't see the whole system changing overnight, and I don't see people seeking that. Mm-hmm. 30 years is still fresh, and people are still in a way rebuilding after the chaos of the revolution. But I think that this is shaking the order of the system to its very core, and I think people will expect to see a fundamental and very important change in the outcome of this election. I don't think they'll be satisfied with a recount or some fudging to satisfy the protests.
BBC video of government supporters firing into crowds of protesters in Tehran on Monday there. We're talking this hour about Iran's turmoil and what's really going on in the uproar. Here's a protester at a rally on Monday saying Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was not the people's choice.
We are here just for saying we know to the Ahmadinejad. We already, all of them, all of us, we said yes to Mir Hossein Mousavi.
A historic turnout in protest of that vote. Supporters in the streets as well. Here's one Ahmadinejad supporter saying the vote was free and fair.
All this unrest is coordinated by foreigners. It is coordinated by Israel and America, and we should strongly confront foreigners.
Sound from Iran this week, where history's being made. Nobody knows where it's going to go. We've been joined from Cambridge, England, by Azadeh Mouaveni. She's author of Lipstick, Jihad, and Honeymoon in Tehran. I'm joined now from Washington by Shaul Bakash. She's professor of Middle East History at George Mason University, author of The Reign of the Ayatollahs, The Politics of Oil and Revolution in Iraq, worked for many years as a journalist in Iran. He left Iran about a year after the fall of the Shah in 1979. Shaul Bakash, thank you very much for joining us.
Glad to be here, Tom.
And with me in the studio, Giv Mirfandreski. He teaches international law and development at Brandeis University, a former professor of international law at Tufts Fletcher School, author of A Diplomatic History of the Caspian Sea, was last in Iran many years ago, but follows it very closely. Giv, great to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Shaul Bakash, we've heard from Azadeh Mouaveni and from Roger Cohen in Tehran. Give us your sort of basic description of what you see going on now in your home country, Iran.
Well, I think if you look at the sweep of recent Iranian history, the great protest movements have often been sparked by a government that crosses a line. At one point, the people feel that they're put up with misgovernment for a long time and then feel a great sense of outrage. And I think what we're seeing now is the outrage over this what they perceive to be a stolen election. What we need to see is whether as Roger Cohen said in the opener, whether the people remain on the streets and continue this protest. Obviously, it faces the government, the regime, with a very serious dilemma.
Outrage is one thing; change is another. What do you see as the stakes here, Shaul Bakash? What's on the line? What could change here or not?
Well, the stakes really are huge, because if you think about it, the people are demanding a new election, and it's almost unthinkable for the government to concede that the elections were fraudulent and that they have to have another vote. So the government is faced either with the choice of making this huge concession to the protesters or a crackdown which could be bloody and cost it a great deal in both internal and international legitimacy. And at the moment, I think it's hard to say which of these two scenarios will play themselves out.
Give me a friend, Dreski. How do you see what's playing here? Do you see a chance, that when this is all over, somehow we'll have a different new president in Tehran? And what are the forces grappling here?
That is very likely to occur. Because
a new president, a different president, Ahmadinejad out, likely?
It is very possible, because this regime has had a history of being extremely accommodationist when it comes to questioning of its very fundamentals, or in a way, when there is an existential challenge to it, it tends to basically circle the wagons and decide these things within the circles of power and the backstage. And in the backstage, we have people now who are essentially all of them claim to be the legatees of the Imam Khomeini, and they all grew up.
The supreme leader,
Of Imam Khomeini, the first
Khomeini, yes.
And of course, many of them have grown up around Mr. Khomeini as well. Mr. Mousavi happened to have been his prime minister at one point. At any rate, they do tend to come to some form of accommodation, particularly given the fact that, as Ms. Mouavani points out, that they don't seem to be wanting to overthrow the entire regime in a fashion. So this is just the way of they're going to tweak it.
Azadeh Mouavani, how about it? I mean, how much do you see people demanding? You said maybe not a fundamental change in order. So then what? And if the presidency is on the line here, if it is there a real challenge to Ayatollah Khamenei, who stands behind it, the supreme leader who's not voted into office?
I think that Khamenei is certainly an extremely vulnerable figure in all of this, because he is seen as the powerful hand that has enabled it all. It would be inconceivable for fraud on this level, if that's in fact what has happened, to have been perpetrated without his acquiescence. So he's very much at the center of all of this, and like we've been hearing, our reading of him has always been that he is very cautious, that he is ultimately very wary of destabilizing the regime, and that he will always choose the middle path. It's his nature. It's how he's dealt with the West, with Iran's place in the region, and that he'll take the course that doesn't open himself and the regime up internally to the kind of rifts that we're seeing today.
Rift, to say the very least. We see people writing, though, that maybe this is just a struggle. As Gibb says, a lot of these leaders on both sides came out of the original Islamic Revolution movement, Ayatollah Khomeini. How do you interpret the sides here, Azadeh?
I think that's a very sort of top-down way of looking at it. I think that that's popular right now in the analysis, to look at this as a sort of factional struggle within the regime, within elements of regime, over competing interpretations of how Iran should move ahead into the future. But I think that with the crowds that we've had and these enormous protests, there's now, it's just a much wider question than that. It's not simply, you know, is it going to be Mousavi and how different will Mousavi be, but will the Islamic Republic be able to maintain any legitimacy after what it's gambled with this election? And will people be able to push through the sort of change that they've expected through the ballot boxes but have never been able to actually accomplish? Will they be able to achieve that through popular protest, which is, I think, the big question.
Shalbakash, do you see the full legitimacy of the Islamic Republic on the line, stakes as large as that? And what would it mean for that to be, you know, for some change that went straight at their central foundational position in this country?
I think Azadeh is correct that the protesters did not start wanting kind of a total change of regime. But if you begin to consider what a compromise might look like, you see how impossible it is. In other words, what can the leaders decide on? Is Ahmadinejad going to stay as president and promise to be more liberal? I mean, that's clearly not the kind of compromise that would be plausible to the crowds on the street. And Mousavi has been cast unexpectedly as the banner bearer of this enormous protest movement. At the moment, he seems to be holding firm. He's called for another demonstration tomorrow to mourn those killed in the demonstration. But again, to emphasize, I find it very difficult to see how there can be a compromise that is a compromise, and therefore the alternatives would be either a crackdown or a concession that Ahmadinejad must go, and that would be a severe blow both to the regime and personally to the leader, Khamenei.
Could that mean a different Iran on the other side? I mean, it seems the protests are gigantic, and yet it's been there for decades. You know, we read of all kinds of power sources and tools of force available to the Islamic Republic and its leaders. I mean, can you really imagine it somehow going away here?
No, and I think the situation is in too much flux, and there's too many uncertainties to predict, because the protesters have to remain on the street, the leaders have to prove they have backbone, the leaders of the opposition, and the state must, you know, decide to refrain from a severe crackdown. We don't know how any of those imponderables will play out in the next few days.
Would you be surprised to see a crackdown here? And is this a movement with its enormous scale? Can it be brought to heel with a crackdown, with more guys on motorcycles and maybe more guns?
It is possible. This regime has shown quite a bit of an appetite for violence in and of itself. Was born initially in a levee of sorts back in the middle 60s. And so it understands violence very well, and it tolerates some of it, and then it also manages to dish it out. What I would look to in terms of signs of whether there will be fundamental change would be to see what happens cyclically at the commemoration of the burials, and then the week after commemorating the dead ones, and then 40 days thereafter, because typically these become symbolic rallying cries during these kind of mass demonstrations. And if the tenacity of the demonstrations continue through a week after the killing of these innocents, and then they become essentially martyred, and then 40 days thereafter, on the 40th of their passing, again you have these kind of crowds in the street, that would then tell you that the crackdown hasn't really worked, and we're looking at something far larger than what we could predict today.
Let's open our phone lines to listeners in Kannapolis, North Carolina. Marvell. Marvell, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. I wanted to talk about the coverage. The coverage is sort of suspect to me because the pictures are always from the backs of people low down and doesn't show accurate portrayal of what's going on. The president, Ahmadinejad, is just a figurehead or a spokesman, and he does not have the power of the country, and the Ayatollah does. And I think this is just a tempest in a teapot. Your guests referred to what's going on in Iran as savage repression, and our protests at our presidential campaigns resulted in cordoning off, limited personal movement, tear gas, some assaults, and jails. And nobody ever referred to that as savage. We really don't know what's going on in Iran, and it just seems that the media is just drum beating sake.
Marvell, let us pick it up. I guess you're talking there about police action last summer in Minnesota that got a lot of attention. I have to say, though, on the other hand, this is not just camera shots from a low angle. We've seen those enormous crowds pretty well photographed. Shaul Bakash, what do you think about how the world media is presenting what's going on in Iran?
Well, it seems to me the coverage has been very good, and we've had scenes of crowds of hundreds of thousands of people demonstrating. I don't see how one can call this a tempest in a teapot. And where the police have attacked demonstrators, it has been brutal. I mean, you've seen these very heavily armed and well-protected police attacking women, demonstrators, playing clothesmen with chains and sticks and guns hidden under their shirts. So it seems to me, yes, where there has been an attack, it has been brutal.
Let's go to Charleston, South Carolina, and Gary. Gary, you're on the air.
Yes, good day. Thanks, Tom.
Hi. Yeah.
I love the show. I have just a question that comes from a common sense issue, which I don't see addressed even in the Iran news. And that is, all the coverage suggests that this was a simple paper ballot. And that would suggest that there would be thousands of people spending days counting, and yet the results were announced only hours after the thing closed. You know, we have computers in this country, and it still takes till 4 in the morning to get the results in. So my question is anyone addressing the common sense issue of the question of fraud and basically the fact that you couldn't count all the ballots in the amount of time they had to make the announcement?
Gary, let us pick it up. And we did learn on Monday that there is computerization in the system, though not universal. Azadeh, what about the simple mechanics here? Do they give credence? Are you in the camp that says this is obviously stolen on its face, the mechanics are impossible, or otherwise, Azadeh?
I think the mechanics are one issue. I think that the way the vote was dealt with in Iran, it's not usual. It's unprecedented to have results announced, any results even officially announced the evening of the vote, and that's what we had last week. And I think that was many people's first inkling that things might be going questionably this time around. The government, of course, argued that several million people had voted very early in the morning and that it had time to count their votes, and there is some degree of computerization to make that somewhat plausible. I think that is, you know, the idea of could they have counted all of the votes by the next day? I mean, I think that announcing the votes so early was the first warning signal that the government was trying to sort of dominate the message of this election from the very beginning. And then what sort of emerged as more murky and more questionable than you know, could they actually have done this so quickly is you know, the margin, I think, as Roger Cohen, I believe it was, who mm-hmm. mentioned Ahmadinejad's margin throughout the country, how well he did in the hometowns of other candidates. And if you just sort of look at there are lots of graphs that have been put out about sort of how he's done across the country. It just looks very, that's what looks the more questionable than the speed and the mechanics of it.
Shaul, our caller Marvell brought up the phrase savage repression, which Roger used, though he was really saying it could still be to come on a greater scale. Do you see that as actually an available alternative to the Ahmadinejad government? Given all the dynamics here, could it just pull out the force tool to respond?
Well, it has been a regime that has been willing to use force and to use it brutally in the past. They haven't been faced yet with demonstrations as massive and as large as this one. But I think, yes, they are capable of it, but clearly hesitant to use that kind of force. And the consequences then are obviously unpredictable.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Iran's turmoil and what's really going on in the uproar there. Supporters of the presidential candidate, Mir Hossein Mousavi, on the streets of Tehran Tuesday, a quieter demonstration than Monday. More demonstrations called for tomorrow, later this week, and some still going on today. People standing on rooftops. Enormous ferment in this country. We're joined from Cambridge, England, by Azadeh Mouavani. She's author of Lipstick Jihad and Honeymoon in Tehran, Iranian-American. With me in the studio, Giv Mefendereski. He is teaching international law at Brandeis University, author of A Diplomatic History of the Caspian Sea, right there on the edge of all this and knows it well. And from Washington, we're joined by Shaul Bakash, professor of Middle East History at George Mason University, author of The Reign of the Ayatollahs. He's the husband of Hala Esfandiari, the Iranian-born scholar who was imprisoned for more than 100 days in 2007, solitary confinement in Iran. And I want to ask all three of you, here's a clip from President Obama speaking yesterday to CNBC, explaining Washington's so far relatively cautious, careful approach to the unrest in Iran.
It's important to understand that although there is amazing ferment taking place in Iran, that the difference between Ahmadinejad and Mousavi in terms of their actual policies may not be as great as has been advertised. Either way, we were going to be dealing with an Iranian regime that has historically been hostile to the United States, that has caused some problems in the neighborhood, and is pursuing nuclear weapons.
Shaul Bakash, in Washington, what do you say about the president's analysis here? You know, this way or that, in terms of actual policy, says the difference may not be so great.
I think there was an unfortunate statement by the president. First of all, there are real differences in terms of the degree of domestic repression and attitudes towards the women and the young in Iran between the two candidates. And I think Ahmadinejad would continue a much more hostile policy, foreign policy, towards the United States and the West than would have been the case with a Mousavi presidency. You know, at the same time, while, you know, it's true that some of the fundamentals will remain the same, Iran's policy, for example, on the nuclear issue will not change dramatically. So, you know, it seems to me that here the president, who has handled this on the whole, I think, very well, misspoke.
Azadeh Mouavani, how do you look at Obama's response so far? He seems to be mindful of the highly interventionist role the U.S. has taken in history in Iran and how this country has been burned by that. And Iranians remember that very well. We heard the tape earlier from the Ahmadinejad supporter saying this is all about foreign intervention. Should the U.S. Be stronger in its attitude and its articulation of criticism here? Should it stay quiet, stay on the sidelines, as Obama seems to be largely doing?
I certainly agree, and I've actually been talking to my friends and relatives in Iran today about this very question, and many of them thought and felt that the U.S. should stay out this time. Some of them felt that way because they thought, well, if Ahmadinejad ends up staying in power, then we need to negotiate with the United States down the line. That might improve our lives. And so let's not undermine relations by having the U.S. seem to be meddling. And of course, the Iranian government responding very predictably, blaming all of the unrest on foreign enemies. I think it's very smart of Washington not to give Ahmadinejad that sort of, or the Iranian government, that kind of pretext. Of course, Ahmadinejad has blamed everything from the price of tomatoes going up to foreign enemies, so he certainly doesn't need any encouragement. But that said, I agree with Shaul. I think that President Obama misspoke. I think it would have sufficed for him simply to say that the very turbulent history between these two countries makes it such that the U.S. Should wait and watch, and not to make comments that would be seen as meddling. I think for him to have said that there's no meaningful difference between Mousavi and Ahmadinejad is very unfortunate. I don't know if he actually believes that or if he's been misinformed, but to live in Iran under an Ahmadinejad-type president versus a more moderate Mousavi-type president is the difference is night and day, and it's very unfortunate to have heard him say that.
Let's go to caller David in Boston. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hello, everyone. How are you?
Very well.
Thanks for taking my call. Just one little comment and a very interesting question I have. Personally, this doesn't seem to me like the average demonstration that they've had, for example, in think it was 99 and 2003.
And by all accounts, it is not. It is much larger, going all the way back to 79, yeah.
With millions of people, and it's much larger than the, yeah, it's like in the 79 or the one when Mossadegh was overthrown, you know, and the Shah was temporarily out of power. But here's another question. This is the question I have is, you've got this Mr. Mousavi, who was the prime minister previous, who was president back in 81 to, I believe, 89. And he was he was there during the war with neighboring Iraq. And he's also got a lot of loyalty within the Revolutionary Guard. But one of his main backers is he is an Ayatollah, I think, Mr. Rafsanjani.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Rafsanjani is considered a real big heavyweight, and he backs Mr. Mousavi, and he's been the subject of attacks by Ahmadinejad. And he currently heads, you know, two of the major councils there in Iran, the Expediency Council, I believe, and something called an Assembly of Experts. And the Assembly of Experts is what interests me, because they sort of are above the Grand Ayatollah. And theoretically, if I'm not mistaken, they have the ability to replace the Grand Ayatollah. So far, in light of the fact that the Ayatollah has actually flinched and, acquiesced and said, well, we'll have partial recount, which I think is kind of, you know, disingenuous. Is it possible that he might be replaced by this Assembly of Experts? And where is Mr. Rafsanjani, or Ayatollah Rafsanjani?
David, let us pick it up, and thank you. Mifandreski, take us into some of the Kremlinology here. I mean, there are any number of power bases here. Ahmadinejad, from everything I'm reading, is more closely supported by the Revolutionary Guard now, but Rafsanjani's there. Describe, paint us a little blueprint there, and what would it take if there were going to be a change, or, you know, what would have to coalesce for a crackdown?
But if we were to actually look at the correlation of these forces in terms of a Rafsanjani camp, inspired camp, spearheaded by Mr. Mousavi in the election, and then we also recall that at one point Mr. Ahmadinejad beat out Mr. Rafsanjani at the last election.
And said, I've swept the sort of corrupt politicians out of office.
Right.
That was his claim.
So this is now a chance perhaps for Mr. Rafsanjani to come back into the fray, but not as the president of the country, but as the next leader. And it is possible, it's very conceivable, that if things get tremendously pushed, that Mr. Rafsanjani will emerge as the next leader. And
neither of these two men as the president, you mean?
That's and then order a new election. It's a distinct possibility. And, of course, it can't really predict history, but given the correlation of these forces, given the history and the it's not been very much of a secret that Mr. Rafsanjani would aspire to greater office, and that's the one left. So if the Ayatollah Khamenei takes it upon himself and takes blame for the mishap, assuming that at one point he has to admit to something going wrong here, and steps down, Mr. Rafsanjani very likely would be the next leader.
Shalbakash, what's your sense of how this conversation takes place, you know, behind the curtain? I mean, is this more or less, I don't know, at gunpoint between these different factions, or do they sit and talk? Is there likely an active sort of dialogue about how do we keep a handle on this, or are they at sword tips and probably not talking?
The Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, did summon representatives of all four presidential candidates precisely to try and reach some kind of a understanding or accommodation. And since Mousavi has called for another protest demonstration tomorrow, we can conclude that they didn't reach agreement. I think it unlikely that Rafsanjani can use his position as the head of the Assembly of Experts to cause Khamenei to step down. I think we're not there at all, and the Assembly of Experts has not played a prominent role in Iranian politics in the last 20 years. I imagine there's some consultation taking place. There are obviously rivalries as well between the factions and individual leaders, but we haven't yet seen, you know, a kind of a massive abandonment of the present structure and the present leadership by key individuals like Rafsanjani. In fact, he's been quite silent throughout this turmoil. So that kind of defection, that kind of deep split in the leadership, which Mr. Mirafandeski referred to, we have yet to see.
Azadev, and the Revolutionary Guard, I mean, we read that they're pretty well lined up with Ahmadinejad. Does he simply have the physical force to deny any effort, even from on high, to oust him?
That's something that's debated very much in Tehran. The Revolutionary Guard is not a monolithic force. There are commanders within it, top commanders, who are viewed as pragmatists, who are not the sort of ideologue, hardliner of the Ahmadinejad style. Its rank and file, similarly, is described as being divided by people who are in a position to know, who are in positions to teach the emerging rank and file of the Revolutionary Guard. The Basij as well, perhaps a bit less so, but I believe in the first election of Muhammad Khatami, many Basijis voted for him. They are equally, like the rest of Iran, victims of a terrible economy, and some of them are aware of that. So I think whether or not these institutions are actually going to step up and participate and be the force that cracks down and enforces this kind of fraudulent election, I think that's something that remains to be seen. It's not definitive one way or the other. Mm.
Let's go to Mohsen in Brookline, Massachusetts. Mohsen, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. How are you? Thank you for the program. Actually, I was one of Ahmadinejad's supporters, okay, because of his foreign policies and the way that he stand up to the bullying of the West,
okay,
toward Iran. But right now, I don't agree with the actions that are taken in Iran, especially against the protesters. One thing that the media doesn't pay attention to is that Ahmadinejad, since he came to power, he was gathering votes for today. In other words, he's been doing things that the other president hasn't been done. He's been going to the villages, to the poor neighborhoods, and he was helping those people to gather those votes for now. Now, if people, they come and say, well, he was handing them the money and he was buying votes, well, we can say in U.S. we have these social programs that, they do it different way, okay? So he was somehow giving these poor neighborhoods some social relief and social programs.
Mohsen, we've got it. I mean, there is a base, no question, that Ahmadinejad has. The question is, was it, did it really bring him this victory? But thank you for your call. Hadi in Lexington, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Hadi.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I actually just got back from Iran. I was there for a whole month. I was pleased to kind of sit down and watch the TV there and watch the debate between all the four candidates. Very democratic, very nice, very civilized, as a matter of fact. And some of the things that I noticed while I was there was Ahmadinejad, as the previous caller said, he was actually campaigning mostly in the rural of Iran, carrying tons and tons of potato bags, believe it or not, distributing potatoes and cash money to villagers.
And what about now, Hadi? What do you think is going to happen now?
Right now, I think with what has happened, and I said this when I was there, I predicted this to my friend, this will bring down the theocracy in Iran, but the democracy will continue. Iranian people are committed to democracy, extremely committed to it. Unlike what the media here tries to tell everybody in the world that there's a lack of democracy in the Middle East, I must say the democracy in Iran is, although it's fledgling, but it is very nicely, it's on its way to becoming a democracy. As you can see, this is the process that any democracy movement should go through. But my prediction is that this will bring down the theocracy in Iran, yet the democracy will live on.
Hadi, thank you very much for your call. Guy Mirafandeski, I mean, the array of options in front of us here and people's expectations all over the map, from Ahmadinejad will hold firm to the very theocracy will fall. It's astonishing. You say watch for the funeral rituals in incoming days, but do you see that much on the line, that range of possibilities here?
Well, I do see a whole range of possibilities, and that is why I think we need to have a more of a longitudinal perspective, not just the 1 week of what has happened, in order to be able to properly diagnose, as far as the U.S. foreign policy will be concerned, exactly who are going to be the emerging horses and which one are we supposed to be betting on in terms of our own relations, future relations with the country. Essentially, what puzzles me is that even if, I mean, this is where I have a problem with people who think that this is truly an arbiter of change, even if Mr. Mousavi had won the vote, that necessarily would not have meant that the hardliners would become completely irrelevant. In fact, they would just go back and do what they did during Mr. Khatami's presidency, which was basically become obstructionists in the parliament and within the different guardian councils and whatnot, and basically frustrate any attempt at any kind of a meaningful reform.
We're going to see a lot more in the days ahead, but with the scale of these demonstrations, we did not want to leave Iran unobserved at all. It's historic what's going on there. The outcome, clearly from our conversation today, nobody knows, but it's just about as big as you can get a foot there right now. Geep, thank you so much for coming in today here in Boston. Shaul Bakash in Washington, thank you very much for joining us this hour.
Thank you, Tom.
And Azadeh Mulvaney, author of Lipstick Jihad and Honeymoon in Tehran, thank you very much for being with us, Ms. Mulvaney.
My pleasure, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. We'll keep watching. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.